Would you turn up Psalm 91? It will be a help to have it open in front of you this morning. Now this psalm, Psalm 91, starts with a statement of general truth, much in the same way as many psalms do, but also in common with many psalms, this general truth is deceptive in its familiarity. Now, of course, we believe that God protects those who trust him. But let's see what the psalm actually says. I'm going to read the first two verses actually in the New International Version, because although the words are almost exactly the same, the grammar is rather more helpful. It goes like this. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. And then the same thought is taken up halfway through the psalm and is perhaps expressed even more clearly in verse 9 and 10. Coming back to the RSV now. Because you have made the Lord your refuge, the Most High your habitation, no evil shall befall you, no scourge come near your tent. No evil shall befall you. Well, that sounds like a stupendous claim. Does it really mean what it says, or does it mean something else? After all, the world isn't really like that. We can't avoid evil in this world. Imagine that tomorrow morning I pick up the telephone to Mike Pedder and say to him, Mike, I wonder if you'd do a job for us. We've just seen this very nice Georgian freehold building, which would be ideal for our office. I wonder if you'd do a survey on it and report back to us. And then very quickly back comes this report, and I open the glossy cover, and inside, instead of 15 or 20 pages, which is what I'm expecting, I see a single sheet which starts with the usual sort of description, this fine Georgian property within easy reach of good shopping facilities, within reach of three tube stations in this historic part of London, and so on. The estate agent, of course, comes out in all surveyors. And then you go through the bits about planning permission and rates and so on, and then down at the bottom of this single page is the heading condition of the building, and all that is said there is we do not anticipate any work will be required on this building for at least 20 years. Well, I mean, you know as well as I do that surveyors don't write reports like that. You know, if there are pessimists in the world, it's surveyors. And of course, surveyors will have plenty of work in this world until that day comes, which is described in Romans 8, verse 21, when the creation will be freed from its bondage to decay. Well, just as bricks and mortar decay, so of course does human nature, human character, human capabilities. We're told that a third of marriages end in divorce, and unfortunately there are many Christian marriages hidden in those statistics, and one could talk about suicides, bankruptcies, all sorts of things. What then does this mean? Apparently addressed to Christians, no evil shall befall you. Well, let's look first at what it doesn't mean. It doesn't, first of all, mean that we won't be surrounded by evil. After all, this whole psalm is about danger. Look at verse 3, the snare of the fowler. Anybody who is known as a Christian is in danger of having traps set for them, aren't they? People love to find out Christians. It's the vicar having an affair who gets into the papers. People love to be able to do that sort of thing. And this phrase in the second half of the verse, deadly pestilence, some commentators think is in the Hebrew, a play on words, and so that it might be deadly word, the idea that somebody says a word of you which sticks. They sling a bit of mud and it sticks. And it's very easy for that to happen to the Christian, isn't it? One of the most impressive things, I think, about Billy Graham is the way that there he is as perhaps the world's best-known evangelist for several decades, and despite all the mud that has been slung, none of it has actually stuck. And then again, in verse 5, the terror of the night. I can think of two Christian friends of mine who speak of experiences where they say that evil has been almost palpable. That's what they felt. And then the arrow that flies by day, the temptation which is so quick or so unexpected that we fall. It just catches us unawares. I remember one day I was with a client in the office talking about his will. He'd been a client for many years. And I knew very well that he had two common law wives living in different places. But he'd never raised this. And then suddenly, quite out of the blue, he turned to me and he said, what do you think about my manner of life? Do you think it's wrong? Well, it took my breath away. I didn't know what to say. I was going to say I was struck dumb. I wish I had been struck dumb, because what I did actually was mumble something about not many men being able to satisfy two women. And so we then passed on, and the opportunity was lost. That so easily happens, doesn't it? We're suddenly caught and we're afraid to come out. Then verse 6, the pestilence that stalks in darkness, suggesting perhaps those who plan in secret to strike down what is good. The destruction that wastes at noonday, perhaps open hostility which finally wears us down, and so on. So it's quite clear that it doesn't mean that we won't be surrounded by evil. Secondly, it doesn't mean that there will be no fight. In fact, just the contrary is suggested by verse 7. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. So others will be falling like flies. And of course, people do succumb to these pressures in big things and in little, don't they? I love my children very much, but I do actually well understand how a mother might end up by battering her baby. We see it reported in the papers and it sounds horrific, but I can well understand a mother on her own, perhaps without a husband, having the constant demand of a baby and being led eventually to that. Pressure does tell, or in the little things, you can't have a builder into the house, can you? But he asks you for cash and tells you that you won't have to pay VAT. You know, that constant little pressure, and one has to stand out against that. One has to stand against the stream. Those boys who were expelled last week from Stowe's school for running a drug ring. Now, I've no doubt that of the 12 involved, only perhaps a couple of them were leaders, and the rest were led. It wasn't that their consciences were dead. It's just that they couldn't stand out against those leaders, and perhaps against the financial inducements as well. So that it doesn't mean we don't have to fight. Now, what does it mean? Well, it means, for a start, that evil won't harm us. Verse 3 tells us he will deliver you. Verse 8 tells us that you will only look. You'll see these thousands falling at your side, but you will only see it happen. It won't touch you. And verse 12, they'll bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone, lest you tumble to your death. So, though the evil attacks us, it doesn't harm us. Now, this, interestingly, is exactly Job's situation. Job was just the sort of man that this psalm is talking about. You may care to turn back to the beginning of Job. It's only a book before the Psalms. And in verse 1 of chapter 1, you see of Job, this is how he's described, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. And then you move on to verses 6 to 12, and there is recorded this conversation between God and Satan. And Satan is saying to God, well, it's all very well for Job. You've blessed him so much. You've given him so much. Let's take those things away and see if you like his attitude then. And particularly, if you look at verse 12, you'll see that God says this, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put forth your hand. Now, whatever else we may learn from that passage, we learn that evil attacks us only by God's permission. So that we can say, if evil comes to us, it's only because God allows it. And at the same time, we can say God's protection keeps us from harm when it does attack. Just before the service, to help me with my sermon, no doubt, Simon handed me a little card. And actually, it's a very apt quotation. Just on this point, Spurgeon, speaking on this psalm, says this, it's impossible that any ill should happen to the man who is beloved of the Lord. Ill to him is no ill, but only good in a mysterious form. Losses enrich him, sickness is his medicine. Reproach is his honor, death is his gain. Isn't that a good quote? The second thing this does mean, no evil shall befall you, it does mean that any can survive and not just the strong. Now, why do I say that? I say that because the dangers that we've been looking at would topple anyone, both the strong and the weak. Look at verse 5, second half of verse 5, the arrow that flies by day. It's the speed that strikes there, both the strong and the weak. Verse 6, the pestilence that stalks in darkness, that takes you by surprise, the destruction that wastes at noonday, some disease perhaps that attacks anybody. Verses 11 and 12, the one who trips and falls to their death. And of course, sometimes one is surprised, isn't one, by the strength of the weak. I think of a friend of mine some years ago who'd just become a Christian and was coming to the Tuesday services, and he worked in a bank nearby, and he walked out after a Tuesday service on his own and immediately ran into two of his colleagues that he actually worked with on the same desk. They saw him coming out of the church. They didn't know that he'd become a Christian, and they mocked him all the way back to the office, and he didn't know what to say. He had no answers. He couldn't think of anything. He was a young Christian, and this worried him very much, and it worried him all through that night. But by the time he went back into work the next morning, he decided what to do. And as soon as he saw the first of these chaps the next morning, he said to him, now, you were taking me to task yesterday for going to church, but how can you do that when you don't even know what they say in there? You come with me and listen, and then judge for yourself. Well, within 6 months, both those friends had also become Christians. And then thirdly, it means that the individual can stand alone. This verse 7 is a very striking verse, isn't it? That one can stand while thousands are falling. It reminds me of that little chorus, dare to be a Daniel, dare to stand alone. Dare to have a purpose firm, dare to make him known. And this thought that the individual can stand is very encouraging to me, as perhaps to many of others of you who feel you're the only Christian witness in the place you work, for instance. It's both a rebuke and a marvelous encouragement, isn't it? So if we have God's protection, we can say that evil will not harm us, that any can survive and not just the strong, and that the individual can stand alone. Now, is this true for any Christian? It sounds as if becoming a Christian gives you a meal ticket for life, doesn't it? Well, now, you'll remember, no doubt, and will have noticed this morning, that the devil, in the second temptation, uses the words of verses 11 and 12 of this psalm in Matthew 4, when he's telling Jesus to throw himself down from the temple. You might just like to turn over to Matthew 4 and see that. You'll see the quotation, which comes in verse 6, and it is taken from verses 11 and 12 of Psalm 91. And then Jesus replies to the devil by quoting, "You shall not tempt the Lord your God." And that's taken from Deuteronomy 6:16. And if you want to turn back to that, you'll find it there. "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test." Now that is said in the context, in that chapter, of the law being given to Israel, and in particular of the great commandment. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might." So that is said, "You shall not tempt the Lord your God," in the context of a relationship of love. So what is it that the devil is trying to get Jesus to do in that second temptation? I wonder if I can put it like this. The only play, in fact, that James Joyce wrote was a play called Exiles. And in one sense, it's the tragedy of a man who puts his wife to the test. He wants her to be entirely free, free of all the sort of bonds of marriage and so on, entirely free, so that any love she gives him is entirely freely given. There's no compulsion about it at all. He almost goes to the point of encouraging her in unfaithfulness. He lets it be known that he won't mind at all whatever she decides to do. And he reaches the point where he can never any longer have anything but doubt about her love. And she does her utmost to assure him that she loves him and has not been unfaithful, and he cannot accept it. He's gone beyond that point. There's a very touching last scene in which he says this to her, "I have wounded my soul for you, a deep wound of doubt which can never be healed. I can never know, never in this world. I do not wish to know or to believe. I do not care. It's not in the darkness of belief I desire you, but in the restless, living, wounding doubt. To hold you by no bonds, even of love, to be united with you in body and soul, in utter nakedness, for this I longed. But now I'm tired for a while, Bertha. My wound tires me." So you see, these promises of God are not to be used to test God's love, but rather to support that loving relationship. Now, if we turn back to Psalm 91, we'll see that this element is also present in the psalm. This love is expressed in three ways at the end of the psalm. In verse 14, "Because he cleaves to me in love, I will deliver him." He cleaves to me in love. It also has the sense of he sets his heart upon me. Susanna, our youngest, for her the place of ultimate security in this world is Mummy's pillow. And very often she'll wake up at night and come down and end up on Mummy's pillow. We'll get up there at night and to go to bed, and there she is. Or perhaps wake up in the morning and unbeknown to us in the middle of the night she's come down and there she is lying between us on Mummy's pillow. That is the place of ultimate security. That is the place that she goes to when she's worried, when, if you like, the pressure is on. I wonder, when the pressure is on, who or what you cling to. What happens when work overwhelms you, or some precious friendship seems to be going sour, or the future suddenly becomes uncertain, or something we'd been planning and looking forward to for weeks is snatched away from us? What is our reaction? Do we find that we are asking bitter questions and complaining to others? Or do we, in Susanna's terms, make for Mummy's pillow? You remember that we discovered earlier that evil comes to us. If evil comes to us, it only comes because God allows it. And any evil that comes, we can be protected from by God so that it doesn't harm us. We need to come back to that. That, in a sense, is the pillow. We know that. Do we make for that immediately when the pressure comes? So that we can say with Paul, nothing shall be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. He cleaves to me in love. And then secondly, verse 14 again, I will protect him because he knows or acknowledges my name. You see, those who are prepared to acknowledge God's name, to stand by his character, to be known as Christians, need protection. And of course, God does protect such people because it's through such people that he makes his name known to the world. Many of you will have seen the film Chariots of Fire. And you'll remember that Eric Liddell, who is down to run for Britain in 100 yards in the Olympics, discovers when he gets on the boat that the heats for the 100 yards, the qualifying heats, are to be run on a Sunday. Eric Liddell was a Christian and in fact was intending to be a missionary. And this for him was a matter of principle. And he couldn't do that. And he had a great battle persuading the people that were running the team that he actually couldn't run on Sunday. And he pulled out. He was actually instead put in, I can't remember if it was for the quarter mile or half mile, and just before the final of the quarter or half mile was run, one of the other athletes handed him a little bit of paper, and he opened it up just before he got down for the start, and it said, "He who honours me, I will honour." And then Eric Liddell went on to win that race. Now, that wasn't intended to be the end of the point. The point is this, isn't it, that he had honoured God by saying, I'm not going to run on Sunday. And then God had honoured him. And what was the result of that? Because he won the gold medal, everybody then heard this story and God's name was honoured. I will protect him because he knows or acknowledges my name. And then the third way in which this love is expressed in the psalm, the beginning of verse 15, when he calls to me, I will answer him. He calls to me. Quite often, Pauline and I, as I expect many of you do, sit down and cut out a whole lot of things that are taking up too much time, which are too far down on the list of priorities. Perhaps some even regular evening things we've just got to cut out. And one is always very conscious of that, and that it's an unpopular move to come back with the news that one's been asked to take on something else that's going to be a regular commitment. I remember some weeks ago coming back and sitting down at supper and just talking about the enormous amount of work that there was in the office and obviously being thoroughly gloomy about it. And later in the evening, Pauline said to me, I really think you ought to come, for some weeks now, you ought to come back and have supper and then go back into the office and get that work done. Now, that was something that I couldn't bring myself to suggest to Pauline. But she had seen the pressure and she'd responded in the way that I couldn't ask. And when we call to God, he will hear what we are really saying. And our requests and our calls to God for help are really at the heart of knowing God's grace, aren't they? Look at the simplicity of the words, when he calls to me, I will answer. There's nothing complicated, no requirement to prove ourselves, simply a knowledge that I'm in need and God can answer that need. And yet Jesus is forced to say to us, you have not because you ask not. When he calls, I will answer. No evil shall befall you. Why? Because you have made the Lord your refuge. Let's just bow our heads for a prayer. Because he cleaves to me in love, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. When he calls me, I will answer him. Lord God, our refuge, we know that these words are true. May we also discover their truth. For Jesus Christ's sake, Amen.